This is The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. on Canada Talks, SiriusXM 167.
Hello and welcome to The Feed with Amber Mack
and Michael B. for everything new now and next.
We have you covered for what's happening in the world of tech and what's trending online.
On the show, how big tech is managing the information war in Russia and beyond.
Plus, we tell you what Airbnb is doing to help 100,000 Ukrainian refugees escaping violence.
Also on the show, World Central Kitchen joins us from Ukraine to share how they're feeding families in need.
And how the war in Ukraine is playing out on Wikipedia in real time.
That's all coming up right here on The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B.
This episode of The Feed is brought to you by Norton, one of the leading consumer cybersecurity brands.
Trending up.
Well, normally we would be ecstatic to be starting the show, but unfortunately, it has been quite the week, is the best way I can put it. I'm, of course, in Brisbane, Queensland, Australia, experiencing some of the worst flooding that the region has seen in over a decade. So it's quite horrific. Some people have lost their lives. Infrastructure has been destroyed. Businesses have been lost. People have been displaced from their homes. So I think if you remember, it was 2020, the last time I was here, and we were here for the bushfires that wreaked havoc across the country as well. So hopefully, Amber, you're having a little bit better of a time, or at least enjoying in some way where you are at the moment.
Well, I think, you know, like you said, it just feels like, it doesn't just feel like, I mean, it is true to say that just as it feels like we are sort of easing up on COVID restrictions in many parts of the world, unfortunately, we have, you know, what's going on in Australia and also, you know, even more prevalent in the news. A lot of what we're going to talk about today is the situation in terms of the Russia attack on Ukraine. And this is a developing story. So we know that it is escalating in terms of the violence. And Michael, I think all we can kind of do on our end as a technology show is share what's happening as far as the impact on online services, how big tech players are trying to step up to help to curb some of the misinformation and disinformation. So I'm keeping a close eye on that, of course. And we have some really phenomenal guests today, Michael, that we're going to talk to a little bit more about this. But wanted to kind of start with the fact that Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, many of the big tech players are actually addressing some of the escalating information war that's taking place online right now. And they're trying to make moves. Every few hours, it feels as though there's a new announcement in terms of how they are either pulling services out of Russia, limiting some of the Russia state actors on social media, and really trying to you know, make a more positive impact in terms of their role during this information war. So lots to talk about on this front. And like I said, a bunch of good guests who are coming up. I'm sure you've heard lots of this news as well, Michael, as far as what's happening with the biggest tech companies in the world and what they're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube have all taken center stage. They've made moves, as you said, to help ensure that ad revenue, for example, isn't being generated by media companies and you know, misinformation organizations or organizations that are spreading misinformation out of Russia and about the attack on Ukraine. What I do... what does give me a lot of hope is how quickly the tech giants have moved to put in these, you know, to prevent this from happening and their moves for this. So I think that is something at least we can, you know, be thankful for and focus on from a positive perspective. You know, lots more are moving. What is interesting, I've seen companies like Airbnb, and this is simply amazing, that they've been offering temporary housing for up to 100,000 refugees from Ukraine, and you're able to join and help if you have in any of the neighboring countries where people are fleeing to, you can go online to Airbnb to see if you can help house these people that have been displaced, or if you do have Places that you used to rent on Airbnb, you can join and help support and offer your place up to these people seeking, you know, just a warm place to stay.
Yeah, absolutely. And wanted to mention as well, you know, we tease this off the top in terms of all the platforms, you know, Wikipedia is another where there's really this information war that is playing out on Wikipedia, and editors, according to Brian Fung, who we have on later, of its Russian language site are debating the appropriate word choice to even describe the conflict in the first place. And it's just, again, it's been just an ever-changing world in terms of what's happening online. And while there is so much happening as far as attacks and physical violence, we're also seeing real information warfare. So we've dedicated a lot of today's show to this conversation. And also we're going to talk about how you are able to help in terms of the hundreds of thousands of refugees who are currently fleeing Ukraine.
Yeah, and I think just very quickly before we move on to the guests, it's also obviously we've seen a lot of sanctions been put in place against Russia. Obviously, now we're starting to see news with regards to crypto exchanges and the different platforms. And so what I do like to stress, what do want to stress here is that, you know, the crypto exchanges have to follow the same sanctions when they're dealing with the banks, just like the banks do. But the controversy that's obviously hitting, they're saying that it's not fair to blanket all Russians when it comes to banning the use of their exchanges. So I think there's just that little nuance I think is important, that obviously they are following the rules and regulations when it comes to the political leaders and the people surrounding them, just like everybody else. So I think that's the only critical thing I'd like to leave there, just to make sure that people aren't getting their news mixed up there. But on the other side of the break, stay with us. We're actually going to be joined by Laurie Siegel. So she's been on the show before. She's written a new book, she has pretty much interviewed everybody you can imagine when it comes to the tech industry and how we've come to know it today.
The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. For everything new, now and next on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167. Power Friend.
You're listening to The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. When Wall Street was crashing and tech entrepreneurs began to rise to celebrity status, our next guest had a front row seat as she rose the ranks at CNN to become the network's senior tech correspondent. Joining us now is Laurie Siegel, who's an award-winning journalist, founder and CEO of .. Media, and recently authored a book called Special Characters, My Adventures with Tech Titans and Misfits. Hi, Laurie, and thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so my first question for you is that I was getting kind of a sneak peek at your book, and I see that it is really a memoir, which I so appreciate. And I really would like to go back to those early days in 2008 when you joined CNN. And what was that moment where you started to get interested and realize that something big was happening in the tech industry?
Yeah, it's interesting because when I started out at the breaking news desk at the time, I remember this is when Barack Obama was elected president. This is when Bernie Madoff had swindled lots of people out of a lot of money, when we were worried about swine flu and we didn't even know about COVID-19. So it was such an interesting time. And I was never even interested in technology. I had ended up going and working for another business portion of CNN. And in my free time, there was just this like emerging group of really interesting entrepreneurs. We were coming out of the recession. It wasn't as cool to go to Wall Street anymore to get a job. And the iPhone had come out, the App Store had launched, and you had a lot of just different people creating and coding these apps. And I used to go after my job, because I worked in the business unit, it was done every day at 4 p.m. with the closing bell. And I would go to these downtown bars and listen to entrepreneurs talk about these ideas like Foursquare, which was a mobile app at the time, and Instagram. And no one had really heard of them at the time. And I caught the bug, and I liked these out of the box thinkers who were doing things different. And that's how I started covering the Airbnbs of the world and the Ubers of the world right when they first launched.
Well, they certainly were doing things different. Over the years, you've been able to see the evolution of these people, their businesses and their character. Who's been the most surprising on where they started to where they are today? And, you know, do we get a little sneak peek of that and their character in the book?
That's a really good question. It's funny. I was recently interviewing somebody for dot, dot, dot. We just launched something called D3. And I said, this is a guy who's now on the Midas list. And I said to him, you know, is it hard because the closer you fly to the sun, the farther it is to, you know, you are from Earth and knowing what people want when you build these products. And so, you know, I think Jack Dorsey, the founder of Twitter, was always really interesting to me because Jack has this like punk rock attitude. He did back in the day. He had like blue hair and he has tattoos. He had a tattoo. And when I first interviewed him, he would show up with no PR people. And I remember when he was starting Square, which, you know, went on to become a really successful company. I was one of the first to put him on camera talking about it. And he just showed up at a coffee shop with this plastic square. And he was like, and he was trying to explain to me why one day we'd be able to accept mobile payments from our phones. And he went to this local coffee shop where he wanted to support the coffee shop. So he wanted to put it on camera. I remember being like, well, how are you going to get these squares out into the world? You know, how's this going to happen? And he was like, well, hand them out on the street if I have to. And there was that real scrappy attitude. And I think Jack is an interesting one because as the problems got more complicated with Twitter and whatnot, you know, he was less accessible and certainly a little bit more buttoned up, especially as they became kind of this a Wall Street company too. But, you know, I think there was always this, because he's from the Midwest, this nature about him. I remember seeing him in Iowa. There's a scene in the book where I see him in Iowa where he's, you know, I was there for a piece on Square and small businesses. And he showed up, and this wasn't on camera, but he showed up with his parents from St. Louis to the shoot, you know, because he wanted his parents to be a part of this thing happening in Iowa. And so there's a part of him that I think never really changed, which I found really interesting, while other parts really did change. And I think it was really tough to see some of the entrepreneurs I knew who were so in tune with disruption and what people could really want become, you know, more and more filtered in their own filter bubbles as, you know, they became the pillars and the power brokers of society and these billionaires.
It's really incredible. And I've watched your work for a long time and also started just around the time that you did in terms of covering the technology industry. And it was an interesting time, but I would also argue that over the years, and I saw this reflected in your reporting and you talk about this in the book, the technology industry as a whole really became more important and prominent in our society. So was there a point where you started to see that, hey, you know, I'm not just this woman in this kind of isolated sector covering this space, but all of a sudden this is going to have implications on everything that we do in our society?
Yeah. I mean, there were a lot of these smaller moments that I was like, whoa, wait a second. You know, this isn't just like this cool punk rock thing that I'm a part of, that these are these renegades changing society. This is real cultural implications. The biggest moment for me was Cambridge Analytica, this Facebook scandal that, you know, that just shook, I don't even want to say like America, it shook everywhere around the world, right? This idea of like, what is Facebook doing with our data and what is privacy in this age? And, you know, I think it was this scandal that everybody cared about. I mean, my mom's not even on Facebook, you guys, and like, she cared about this scandal, you know, and I had interviewed Mark Zuckerberg during that time and kind of had a behind the scenes look at Facebook, this company in crisis during that time. And, you know, I remember walking into Facebook and how quiet and cold it was and how everything felt really small when there was like crisis comms and this big moment where Mark Zuckerberg was going to speak for the first time and apologize. And he was going to do it on camera with me. And we had such a small setup, like just like a couple little cameras to do it. And the room was like the first room we were in wasn't cold enough. So we went to the next room, which was freezing, by the way. But it just seemed like this moment that even though it was small inside of Facebook, I knew that interview, and it was the first time he said that they'd be open to regulation and that, you know, he would go and potentially testify. And I just knew that this was this moment that technology had become so, so much larger than a beat. It had become, you know, something that shaped society and that we all needed to be paying attention because it was certainly not all positive. And I think we've all gotten there now, but it was definitely a turning point.
And so you have interviewed so many different people, obviously working at one of the most iconic news brands in the world. Yes, it was a great opportunity, but how do you move on from there? And because you are more than just someone who reported at CNN, I mean, you've now taken all of this experience and become an entrepreneur yourself. What gives you hope when you look at where we are today with social media and media organizations like the one you have started?
You know, I think for me, and it was an interesting decision to leave CNN, right? Like I remember, oh my God, I'd interviewed everyone. By the time I decided to leave, I'd interviewed so many of the big players. I'd probably interviewed Zuckerberg multiple times on that last year and Dara from Uber and Benioff and all the big, and Tim Cook and all the big tech players. And for me, I just wanted more. I thought there was a bigger space for nuanced, interesting reporting about technology and humanity. And when you sit across from these people who shape their own things, like I started getting that bug, you know, of like, I really want to do my own thing. I want to build out my own environment and shape my coverage. And this was, by the way, cable news had also changed and there was less room for long form reporting. And it was a lot more, you know, pundits and whatnot and a political and polarizing environment. And so, you know, it was a really scary move. And I think a theme in the book is this idea of lobster moments. When I was quitting my job with Jeff Zucker, who was my mentor at CNN, he was the president. I said to him, I'd become obsessed with this this video of a rabbi talking about how lobsters grow, and the only way for lobsters to grow is for them to completely shed their shells, and it's stressful, and you're very vulnerable, and it's pretty miserable for the lobsters, but it's the only way they get bigger. And I just remember sitting there with Jeff and like, he's like, you know, just stay, give me some interviews. We can work out something. And I was just like, I said to him, I was like, Jeff, I have to tell you how lobsters grow.
I just want to be a lobster when I grow up.
Yeah. I was like, that's exactly it. I was just basically like, I'm having a lobster moment. Like you got to let me go. I got to go. And it's these moments of growth that are so painful. But they are the things that define us. And I think that's the same for entrepreneurs. So, you know, I've gone out and I've created my own media company and we're focused now on this next generation of the internet that I could speak about for hours, but I won't, called Web3, which is NFTs and the metaverse and crypto. And I get to do it from a female point of view and with all the things I've learned. And that makes me optimistic. I mean, it makes me optimistic that, you know, that I'm not completely hiding under a rock after 2 years of being an entrepreneur. That's optimism. But, you know, I also think I'm optimistic because I really still believe in the power of journalism and the power of storytelling. And I believe that we are going through a fundamental shift. And I believe that people need trusted voices now more than ever. And I believe that social media and these tech companies have been and are being held accountable, and that we're on the dawn of a new era where we have a reset coming and we can, you know, this is when it comes to the internet, and we can ask a lot of these hard questions now. We are entering another generation of the internet that's more immersive, that's called Web3. And we will have different opportunities to learn from what we learn, all the mistakes of the last decade. So I'm optimistic.
Well, listen, we want to encourage everybody to check out your book, get their own copy. Again, it's called Special Characters, My Adventures with Tech Titans and Misfits. Thank you so much for joining us today, and we appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Up next, if you like Wordle, we have some word games you might want to download today.
The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. For everything new, now and next on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167. Apptastic.
All right, now it's time for Apptastic. And today we are going to talk about some apps that are really perfect for people who like puzzles and word games. Michael, maybe I'll throw this over to you because you picked all of these. Where was your head in deciding this was a good theme beyond just the Wordle period that we're in right now in terms of its popularity?
So what happened was I went down a rabbit hole on social media, and you know, I don't normally spend too much time on social media, and I lost my mind with people's grammar. So I thought, if you're going to say just silly things on social media, at least be grammatically correct. So what I thought was we would do a public service and we would share some amazing apps that would help people's grammar and vocabulary, so at least they're going to sound smarter and be more correct when it comes to posting. Do you like my rationale there?
I lost my
mind with commas and full stops and all kinds of stuff.
I'm just waiting for you to stumble over something that you're saying. So we'll see if these apps have worked or not. Okay, so let's start with the first one, Michael. It's like you said, it can help you build your vocabulary. It's a free app called Magoosh, which looks like an app for iOS devices.
Yeah, so it's got 1,200 vocab words picked by expert tutors. What I like about this is it gives the definitions and examples of sentences for every word. So I don't know if you ever watched game shows when you were a kid where they would say the word and then someone would say, can you use it in a sentence? This is what kind of made me giggle. But there's all different levels, your basic, your intermediate, and advanced vocabulary. So hopefully, as you learn more words and you get better at it, you can advance to those more difficult vocabulary sections within this. And again, if you can beat your levels, it unlocks new words and you can track your progress as you're studying and learning more and more.
Well, I love this. I do love word games and I love anything that helps you with your vocabulary. The next one we have is a word building game that has puzzles. It's called Seven Little Words. And this looks like a fun one. It also looks like maybe you could even, I don't know, play this with your family. I think it looks pretty family friendly, unlike something like Loodle. You guys can look that up. But nonetheless, it kind of scrambles words in these little bite-sized puzzles. Is that correct?
Yeah, pretty much. So you've got word find games, anagrams and jumble games or crosswords. All different types of these little unique puzzles that are built in to help, learn more words. So basically, I think it's about 25 puzzles that you can play for free. The app basically includes more than 10,000 puzzles. So I think that then obviously you've got that ability to unlock more as you play the game as well. So it's a pretty fun game. I think you're right. It is for everybody, different levels, especially if you are walking somewhere or waiting for public transport and you've got 5 minutes to kill. This app, I think, would be one of the best ones because you don't have to get so engrossed in it that you need a considerable amount of time to play it.
Yeah, I think I like that because it's kind of quick, which is good. I mean, I think that's really, let's be honest, why Wordle has caught on is that, you know, for most people, it's a few minutes out of your day and there's only one game. And you know, again, you can kind of dip in and dip out. And I think people really appreciate that, you know, unlike maybe a crossword puzzle from the New York Times, where you have to spend arguably a whole lot more time. This is a good
one. They're much longer. No, so this one, yeah.
Yeah, so Vocab Genius, it is an app that applies the latest in cognitive science techniques with more than 1,000 flashcards covering vocabulary, words, and their roots. Very cool.
This one's, I think, would be great if you were studying, especially if you're a teenager and in high school. And so basically, it has over 800 flashcards for some of the most useful yet difficult vocabulary words in the English language. As you said, so it has the definitions, it has sample sentences, it has synonyms, and it really does help with the studying and the remembering. And the way it goes about it, you can check in and then it can alter the way you are learning to make it more efficient and obviously then be able to remember it as well, which is always handy. They have over 300 word elements flashcards for common prefixes, suffixes, and roots. So obviously, I think I just said three words that probably freaked a lot of people out and made them go back to English in school. It's been many, many years.
It is possible. I always love to look up the reviews of these apps. And I do just want to add before we wrap up that all of them have pretty good reviews as well. So that is always really, really handy if you are looking to pass some time. And next up, Michael, we're going to talk about how people can give back and help, and really a wonderful story out of Ukraine in terms of an organization that's doing some really important work.
Absolutely. So stay with us. And of course, if you've got an app, gadget, or product you think we should check out, tweet us at Amber Mack and at Anne Bancroft AD and use the hashtag #TheFeed.
The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. For everything new, now and next on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167. Techstar.
You're listening to The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. Earlier on in the show, we talked about what big tech companies are doing in the wake of Russia's attack on Ukraine. To talk more about this ever-evolving story and these developments is CNN's tech reporter, Brian Fung. Hi, Brian.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
You know, we realize that this is a fast-moving story in terms of how the big tech players are reacting. But we wanted to start with just an overall question in terms of what some of the big players are doing. What are some of, the highlights that you're seeing in terms of these big tech companies actually making moves within Russia and beyond?
Sure. So one of the major steps that we've seen tech platforms take is actions to limit the reach of Russian state-owned media outlets or state-backed media outlets. And that falls into several categories. You had Facebook and YouTube, for example, limiting access to RT and Sputnik, both within Ukraine as well as across the European Union now that the European Union has, issued an order basically banning Russian state media outlets across the EU. We've also seen a number of services remove Russian state media outlets from their app stores, which Apple has done and Google as well. And we've also seen Apple just in the last day say that it's suspending all sales of its products and services within Russia. If you look on social media, you can see lots of empty shelves and stuff like that to kind of underscore the point that Apple is no longer providing many of its services or products in Russia. And I believe there was also a screenshot or a picture that was circulating around social media showing how many people were unable to use Apple Pay in the Moscow metro because of some of the restrictions as well. So that's kind of what we're seeing right now. Obviously, as you said, it's a fast-moving situation, and pretty much every day we're seeing new announcements by companies, cutting ties with Russia or limiting the reach of Russian state media.
And speaking of new announcements, most recently we've seen the Ukrainian government calling for Russia to be disconnected from the global internet. Is this something that's realistic and or could be done? And what are those kind of implications that kind of come with something so severe as that, as disconnecting them from the internet?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it really kind of highlights for a lot of people, there have been, for years, ethical debates about, how countries should conduct themselves in cyberspace in the middle of a war. And now, these theoretical debates are no longer theoretical. They're very real, and they're here with us, facing us now. The question about disconnecting Russia from the internet is an issue that Ukraine proposed to ICANN, which is the global nonprofit that's based in the U.S. that manages and oversees much of the infrastructure of the internet. And what Ukraine is asking for essentially is for all of the country level domains that are associated with Russia. So .ru, for example, and its Cyrillic equivalents to be basically cut off from everyone else. And it's also asking for the entities that assign IP addresses to essentially take back all of the IP addresses that have been assigned to Russian devices and Russian websites. And according to a number of experts that we've spoken to, this would have several effects. It would, one, make it impossible for anyone outside of Russia to, you know, log on to Russian websites or to email Russian email addresses. And then second, it would make it very hard for Russian individuals, Russian internet users to get on the internet. There are a number of reasons why this proposal is not feasible, beginning with the fact that, you know, the ICANN is not a government. It operates by consensus, and there are many different organizations that are a part of it. And getting everyone to agree that this is something that should be done is kind of a far-fetched idea, especially given the potential unintended consequences. But then also, you know, from a technical level, the internet is, you know, managed by so many different businesses and organizations that it would be very hard to, you know, ever successfully cut off Russia from the internet. As one expert told me, you know, there's no central button, there's no switch you can flip that just would, you know, turn off a country's internet connection overnight.
Absolutely. And I know, again, this is an evolving story. One question we did want to ask you is what's happening right now when it comes to Twitter? And you know, even though, you know, in the big tech world, they're perhaps less of a player, we know that over the course of the past few days, that Russian state media has had a presence there. And just curious what the latest is on that platform.
Yeah, so Twitter made an announcement on Monday saying that any link shared by any of its users to a Russian state media website will automatically be labeled, and users who see that tweet will, you know, have a warning basically saying you're about to click through to a Russian state-owned media channel. And anyone looking to share that, you know, information would potentially be presented with a warning. And Twitter said, you know, it was doing this because it already labels Russian state media accounts, but that since the invasion began, most of the content linking to Russian-owned media entities is actually being shared by individual users and not by the accounts run by the media outlets themselves. And so by labeling not just the accounts, but also the links that people are sharing to these websites, the idea is that it would better add more context to what people are seeing. And then, you know, another step that virtually all of the major social media companies are taking is demoting or downranking the content and accounts of Russian state media in their respective platforms, so that you know, their algorithms don't recommend this content to users as often, or doesn't surface it as highly in the, you know, news feeds as you might otherwise expect.
Well, listen, we are so grateful that you joined us today, and we do want to encourage people to follow you online and follow all of your reporting. So, where's the best place for people to go?
Sure. Well, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at @B_Fung, F-U-N-G, on Twitter. And you can also find my content online at CNN.com.
Well, listen, Brian, thank you so much for being here and keeping us up to date on this story. And thanks for joining us on the feed.
Thank you.
Up next, how World Central Kitchen is helping feed families in the wake of the invasion of Ukraine.
The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. For everything new, now and next on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167. In the Spotlight.
This is The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. When there's a crisis, the World Central Kitchen, also known as WCK, is one of the first organizations on the ground providing meals to families and people in need. Joining us now is the organization's CEO, Nate Mook, who will share how WCK is serving thousands of fresh meals to Ukrainians fleeing the country, as well as those who remain at home. Nate is joining us from Western Ukraine. Hi, Nate, and thanks for being here.
Hello, Amber. Thanks so much for having me.
The first question we have for you is just what is going on in the ground right now? Can you give us a sense of some of the work that you're doing, how it started, and how it's evolving?
Absolutely. So as you said, I'm in Lviv, Ukraine. So this is a city, a large city in the western part of Ukraine. So things at the moment are relatively peaceful here now compared to, say, Kiev or Kharkiv and some of the other cities in the east that are being heavily bombarded by the Russians. The situation here is very tense, though. Everybody is preparing. There's also been threats from Belarus in the north. Those troops theoretically could head south straight to Lviv. There's a lot of just roadblocks being built and barriers set up, and folks are preparing Molotov cocktails, and so a lot of tension. Even though during the day things are, you know, somewhat normal, all things considered, restaurants are open, stores are open, up until the curfew sets in around 8 p.m. So we're here here in Lviv because many thousands, tens of thousands of Ukrainians are being displaced from those attacks in the east and are heading west to cities like Lviv. Thousands of people are waiting at the train station in Kyiv, for example, to get out to Lviv. And when they arrive here, they've been traveling sometimes for many hours and sometimes days. And so we're providing fresh, hot meals to those displaced families here in Lviv and also in the surrounding areas. We're about an hour and a half from the border with Poland. And so from here, we're also serving some of the families that are waiting to enter Poland. There are long lines at the border crossings on the Ukrainian side as families are trying to escape Ukraine and get into Poland. We have World Central Kitchen teams set up all along the Polish border, on the Poland side of the border as well, at all of the border crossings. So as families finally make it across the border, start to get situated, they can get a hot meal when they arrive and start to begin to plan their next steps, whether to stay in Poland or to move on to other countries or to see friends or family. It's a really evolving, fast-moving situation. Things are changing rapidly. Nobody really knows what's going to happen next. And so we've really just had to adapt in real time. We have a number of restaurant partners and food producers in Poland that are producing meals along the border. And we've activated restaurants all throughout Ukraine as well. So here in Lviv, but also in cities like Odessa and Kharkiv, and even in Kyiv as well, we're able to serve meals through those local partners. And then we can sort of coordinate all of that. So it is a very complex mission at the moment, but we're really just focused on making sure that families have something to eat, something hot and fresh to eat, because it is also very, very cold in this part of the world right now.
So it definitely is, as you've alluded to, a mammoth task from a strategic just from a supply chain perspective, and being able to supply all of these meals and get food to your location. What is the best thing people that aren't there and aren't able to help, what can they do? Is it jumping online and donating money and in that respect? And how do we ensure getting the food to you guys and helping you on the ground?
It's a great question. I know people all around the world right now are watching this situation unfold, watching these attacks happen, and just, you know, want to do something. I think one of the best things to do right now, if you're, of course, not in the region and able to come and volunteer in person or to help out in places like Hungary or Poland, is to honestly to donate to organizations that are on the ground working. That money can go directly to in our case, purchasing meals, purchasing food, making sure that we're able to get those meals to those families in need. There are a number of organizations that are here on the ground that are doing great work. There's also a lot of volunteers that are just showing up. And so we're trying to also support those volunteer groups. It's an incredible outpouring of support right now. You know, amidst this tragedy, there's just this incredible humanity as both other Ukrainians that are not in Ukraine right now, or Polish residents, or in countries like Romania and Moldova and Hungary, all step up to support those Ukrainians and others that were living in Ukraine who are being affected right now. So what I would recommend is see what's happening, follow closely what's happening online, see what organizations are doing, make sure you see direct impact of their work. And I think donations are one of the best ways to support right now.
One question I have for you is just about the next few days. And I do realize it's impossible to predict what is going to happen, but it is true, and you alluded to this as well, that there's an escalation that is taking place. How do you plan to continue to help during a crisis that's moving as quickly and as violently as what's in front of you today?
So one of the things that we're really focused on is, in addition to the immediate response that our teams are undertaking right now at the borders, and we're working 24 hours a day with our partners, making sure, because, you know, families are coming across 24 hours a day at the borders, or they're waiting all night long for many, many hours. So in addition to that sort of acute emergency response, we're also preparing for potentially a very large humanitarian need right here in Western Ukraine. You know, at least at the moment, if it stays a bit peaceful here, more peaceful rather than other parts of Ukraine, we're expecting to see a huge influx of Ukrainians that are shifting, that are having to flee the east and head to the west. And this is already happening. We're serving meals here in Lviv, where I am, at the train station, and every day trains are pouring in, packed to the gills with families. I mean, people are having to sit on the floor. There's no space. Everybody is crammed together as they're trying to get away from the areas that are being bombarded. So potentially we could be looking at millions of Ukrainians that get displaced. Ukraine is a very large country, and you know, unfortunately, a lot of families have nowhere to go. Even they can't really even leave. They may not have the money to do so. They may not even be able to get to the border. And so we're expecting a huge amount of internally displaced families here. And so that's what we're working on right now. We're trying to get access, supply chains up and running. We're getting a channel, getting a corridor from Poland into Ukraine, working with the United Nations and the World Food Program to set that up. And then working with some of the government here in Lviv to identify places where we could potentially set up a huge kitchen that could produce, you know, hundreds of thousands of meals if needed for this humanitarian crisis that really could be upon us in a very short time. So really it's constant adaptation, but also looking a little bit into the future and saying, you know, if the worst happens, what can we do to at least be ready as much as possible?
And Nate, before we let you go, we know that all eyes are on Ukraine, but when we look at the World Central Kitchen, you've been helping all over the world, not just in crises like this, but when it comes to climate, and it can destroy countries and displace citizens all over the world. I know that in 2020, you guys were, you know, helping with regards to Australia and the bushfires and the crisis that we faced, and I'm currently in Australia at the moment, and we're dealing with some of the worst floods we've experienced in Queensland in over 10 years. So can you just, before you leave us, explain to us just the sheer extent of World Central Kitchen globally on how you do help communities from around the world, and also how people, if you are a chef, if you are somebody in areas that are in need, how they can get involved with the programs that you have.
Absolutely. You know, responding to a war like this is actually fairly new for us. You know, typically our work really is focused on oftentimes natural disasters. We actually have a team still in Madagascar right now that was hit by two massive cyclones recently. We were recently in Brazil for the floods. We actually have a team right now in Indonesia responding to an earthquake that just took place. And as you mentioned, we are responding to wildfires all around the world in places like California and Greece and Australia in 2020. So, you know, it's the world is changing. We're seeing bigger storms happening more frequently, bigger wildfires, you know, and unfortunately, this wreaks a lot of havoc on communities. And so over the past 4 years, we've been finding ourselves cooking all over the world, and we have teams that are responding. So that's, you know, we're trying to do our best. We're trying to meet the needs, and this is what we found ourselves doing. And, you know, as the world climate shifts and as the world becomes warmer and as climate disasters really become something that the world faces all over, World Central Kitchen is having to be there. So we work with chefs and restaurants all over the world. Whether we're cooking ourselves or activating local restaurants that are already in communities to serve their own communities, the best way to get involved is to you know, follow our work either on our website at wck.org and of course on social media. Our founder, Chef Jose Andres, you can follow him as well. He's here on the ground with me in Ukraine right now, and see what we're doing. Contact us. We have an incredible network of chefs all over the world. Join our chef network. You know, we really like to think of ourselves, World Central Kitchen, we are a community, and we couldn't do the work that we do without this incredible network of chefs and food suppliers and the community that's on the ground jumping in to volunteer, whether to make a sandwich or a salad or deliver meals. And so, you know, join us. You know, that's how we're able to do what we do. And of course, we're grateful for everybody that gets involved. So that's what I would recommend for those that want to learn more and to jump in.
Well, listen, again, we appreciate you taking time out of your day. Be safe. And once again, what we want to encourage people to check out World Central Kitchen online and see how they can help. Thank you so much for being here. And please extend our concern and our support to your entire team. And thanks for joining us on the feed.
Thank you so much.
Up next, how the worst of social media took center stage at the State of the Union address this week.
The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. For everything new, now and next on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167. Socially Speaking.
Before we get to Socially Speaking, we are going to share a cybersecurity tip that is brought to you by Norton. Now, as tax day gets closer, be on the lookout for tax-related scams. Criminals know that filing taxes can be complicated, and the stressed-out consumers can be more likely to fall for phishing scams. A good example of a phishing scam is when a cyber criminal sends a fraudulent message designed to trick you into revealing information or deploying malicious software on your device like malware. They know that many taxpayers are happy to pay others to file their taxes for them, often without checking the credentials of these preparers. And that means that we all have to be extra vigilant for phishing emails, ghost tax preparers, and even phone calls from scammers pretending to be your advocate. To help protect the personal information on your devices, make sure to install device security software. Now, no one can prevent all cybercrime or identity theft, but Norton 360 is what I trust to help protect my devices and my family's devices against cyber threats. For more information, visit Staples in store or online. Okay, guys, now we're going to chat about the State of the Union address, which just happened a few days ago with President Biden. And typically in these addresses, you don't necessarily hear a lot about what's happening in the tech space. But this one was a little bit different because one of the things that President Biden spoke about was the impact that big technology companies are having on the next generation. And it was telling that one of the guests who was invited to the State of the Union address was Frances Hogan, who many people will remember as the Facebook whistleblower who shared how many of the products that Facebook, now Meta, designs within the Facebook and Instagram ecosystem do in fact really lead to many issues with children and their mental health because those platforms can be addictive and harmful. So after she was introduced at the event, I was on Twitter and noticed she had tweeted out a number of different messages, just sort of picking up on the theme of the night. So Erin, maybe I'll start with you. I don't know if you watch the State of the Union. I know as Canadians, you know, it's not something we all watch. But what is your reaction to hear the president talking about this? Because I in contrast, in Canada, think sometimes we don't really address the issues that are happening in the digital space as seriously as we just saw this week.
I did not watch a State of the Union address. I do not watch State of the Union addresses. I saw some memes float by on Twitter that night, whatever night it was. It's interesting to be mentioned, but I feel like it's ultimately not going to be followed through upon and might be an empty gesture because, look, big tech is also big business, and big business equals big political donations, and big political donations can sway politicians and legislation. So I don't think that big tech companies are going to contribute to politicians that are going to curtail them. So I don't know. I feel like it's lip service off the start, and it's good press, and it's good for social media, but I feel like nothing's going to come of it.
Well, that is interesting. I feel like you always give us your sort of the sober second thought. Michael, what was your reaction? Were you pleased to hear these discussions happening, or do you think it helped to highlight it, or was it just paying lip service to a growing problem?
No, I think that when it comes to something like the State of the Union address, the amount of thought that goes into each and every word, because this isn't just something that is said for the sake of saying it. There is quite an important ceremony. This is whoever is in charge of America at the time lays out their plan for the next 12 months or even, you know, 2 years or whatever it might be. And each year they then reinforce that. And you know, it's not just Americans that focus and watch this and hang on the every word. It's global. This is one of the few leaders of the world where you do hang on every word, because you still, regardless on how we've experienced the last few years, you know, the president of the United States is still a leader you look to follow suit. And I think that it's exceptionally important that, you know, President Biden mentioned that it is time to strengthen privacy protections, ban targeted advertising to children, demand tech companies stop collecting personal data on our children. So for him to say that on a global stage, I think is exceptionally important. And I do think that we are going to see at least people that have been elected try to bring new policies to get passed to help with these goals. And we do know that it is, a massive problem. And people like Francis, as you said, have actually helped not only highlight it and bring it to the world stage, but also brought proof. And I think that's also important.
Yeah, and it's worth mentioning that one of her tweets before we wrap up, she says, "We cannot let Meta run the same playbook on our kids and families that Big Tobacco did a generation ago by hiding research about the addictive, harmful nature of their products." So some pretty powerful words there. We'd love to hear what all of you think in terms of your reaction on this being mentioned during the State of the Union address, whether you're in the US, Canada, or beyond. Please let us know. We're easy to find on social media at Amber Mac and at mbancroft80. And of course, please use the hashtag The Feed.
This is The Feed with Amber Mac and Michael B on SiriusXM Canada Talks, Channel 167.